Phoenix Audio presents Who's Killing the Great Writers of America? By Robert Kaplow. Read by R.T. Johnson.
Who's Killing the Great Writers of America is a work of fiction. Although the story is set against the background of actual people and places, those people and places have been completely reimagined in the spirit of parody and burlesque. Robert Kaplow. Hip the canary, it'll be scary after the warm-up. Johnny Mercer. Chapter 1. Diarrhea on the Orient Express. As she studied an elderly woman with a walker, Sue Grafton thought, "We watch our friends one by one grow sick and die, and then one day they watch us grow sick and die." Grafton shook the thought out of her head. This was supposed to be her birthday trip. She turned for more life-affirming language to her paperback of Madame Bovary. No one can ever express the exact measure of his needs, his conceptions, or his sorrows, and human speech is like a cracked pot on which we beat out rhythms for bears to dance, to when what we really long for is to make music that will wring tears from the stars. Ain't that the fucking truth, she thought. She sat in the Stazione Ferrovia Santa Lucia in Venice. In front of the marble rectangular column in front of her, rising out of a mountain of luggage, stood a brass frame. It bore the sign, Venice Simplon Orient Express, boarding time. Beneath the words was a drawing of a clock, pale blue hands against the darker blue background. The clock indicated 10:25. Next to the sign stood a large bald man in a khaki short-sleeved shirt talking on a cell phone. His hand obscured his face and the sun glinted off his aluminum attaché case. He'll be the killer, thought Grafton, whose mind was nearly always working in that direction. Kinsey will meet him on the train. No, there was a more interesting-looking guy behind him, a muscular young black man in a white shirt with a perfectly sculpted face. He wore a silver bracelet. Kinsey will meet him on the train. He's the rap star. Gives her a CD with a picture of him on the front, dressed in a white suit, black tie, and a black cashmere scarf. He's holding a wireless microphone. The title of the CD is Big Nig. I don't know how to say this, Kinsey will say, raising her eyebrow, but isn't that a little, how do I say it, in terrible taste? Terrible taste? Asks the man. A big nig, isn't that a little self-deprecating? It's like, I don't know, but you'd never hear a Jewish lesbian pop star calling herself Kike Dyke. No, Kinsey. His voice is softened by an English working-class accent. You've got it all wrong. It's Big Nige. My name is Nigel, soft G, long I. Big Nigel. Oh, my God, I'm so sorry. Grafton looks at the CD. The label is Engorged Phallus Records. The blurb reads, A Seminal Work, Kelefasana, New York Times. All right, maybe that angle won't work. Too offensive, too early. Grafton looked back up towards the marble column to see that the black man had disappeared into the crowd. One second you're the star of my book, she thought, and the next second you don't even exist. It certainly was a strange moment when you crossed paths with a writer who was gathering. She'd borrow at least that silver bracelet. She'd make it a white gold, 18-carat, engraved identification bracelet, and they find it next to the dead body where it has conveniently fallen in the struggle. Perhaps too conveniently, thought Inspector Magritte, the celebrated surrealist detective. The overweight American mystery writer's body lay hideously contorted on the railroad tracks. Using pale lavender latex gloves, Magritte picked up the identification bracelet. On one side was engraved Nigel. On the other side was engraved From Everyone at E.P. Engorged phallus? Asked the inspector's willowy blonde assistant. No, said Magritte. I'm actually feeling quite relaxed. He continued to examine the large cement sewage drain next to the body. Ce n'est pas un pipe, he suddenly cried, as a locomotive roared out of the fireplace, destroying his bowler. Grafton shook her head. She had to stop her mind. Maybe she really had written herself out. Her heart told her she should have stopped with Z is for Zero Coupon Bond. But no, her cheerily well-heeled publisher had pushed and hammered and harangued her. She groaned a little as she reread the typed letter which now served as a bookmark in her Madame Bovary. So glad to hear you have finally begun work on AA is for Aardvark. Everyone in office convinced this will be your biggest hit yet. Possible title for later book in series, DD is for Double D. Psychotic Beverly Hills surgeon makes women's breasts so large they suffocate as they sleep. Funny movie possibilities. All best, Jerry Goniff, President, Posthumous Press. P.S. Aardvark already in spring catalog. Best pre-order since W is for Wank. She groaned again. A.A. is for Aardvark. How on earth could she get a book out of that? When she'd visited New York last month, having lunch with her editor and publicist from Posthumous at some lovely Italian place on 9th, she'd been quietly preoccupied with the problem of inventing a story that could even remotely accommodate the title A.A. is for Aardvark. And how would the third series start? A.A.A. is for Penlight Battery? No wonder Sir Arthur Conan Doyle had finally killed off Sherlock Holmes. She could still recite from memory the last sentence of The Final Problem, still loved the music of that closing cadence, an elegy for him whom I shall ever regard as the best and wisest man whom I have ever known. A beautifully shaped sentence, Grafton thought, right down to the double use of the word whom. That stilted formal word choice gave it the swallowed choke in the throat, the Victorian gentleman in his tweeds, mutton chops, and tight wool necktie holding back his tears as he closed the weighty tome on Mr. Sherlock Holmes. His limits. Of course, the great clamorous Victorian public had pushed and hammered and harangued poor Conan Doyle until the doctor relented, propped up the corpse for 13 more stories of The Return of Sherlock Holmes, two remaining novels, and two more story collections, His Last Bow and The Casebook of Sherlock Holmes. Poor Conan Doyle. It was like Weekend at Bernie's Part 35. And poor Holmes. His corpse dressed up in a Hawaiian shirt and dark glasses, somebody shaking his arm goodbye. She hoped to God Kinsey wouldn't exit that way. Have the decency to send her hurling over Reichenbach Falls locked in the arms of her Professor Moriarty. Consign them both to a watery eternity. Maybe Kinsey's final story could be called Her Last Bow. But the bow wouldn't be a stage bow. It would be a pink ribbon tied in a bow. A suitably feminine touch for the finale of perhaps the most likable female private eye in the business, the Boston Globe. Actually, Grafton thought, there was something slightly dismissive and repellent about the word likable. Was Emma Bovary likable? It was precisely her irresponsibility and selfishness that made her so compelling. The last thing on earth she could be called was likable. The sisterhood of the shared sanitary napkin was likable. Mystic Pizza was likable. The Babysitter's Club and those endless chick books with the pink and green covers and the pictures of the shopping bags. That shit was likable. Kinsey deserved better. Reader, I killed her. Maybe this would be the trip where cruel Sue Grafton murdered her forever 30-something heroine.